The reading from God's Word tonight is from Isaiah chapter 9, verses 1 to 7. Please follow with me in the Church Bibles on page 693. Isaiah chapter 9, starting at verse 1. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future he will honour Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle and every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. And of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. This is the word of the Lord.
Well, I want us to step back, if we may, tonight, to the time when that passage was written. The date is about the 8th century BC, and the issue being addressed by the writer is this. Has God given up on his people and his promises? Has God given up on his people and his promises? There's no doubt about it that the vast majority of God's people have given up on God. And God is about to bring judgment on them. Like the Iraqis on the Kurd borders in the mid-90s, the Assyrian armies were poised on the northern borders of Israel. In fact, they'd already begun to invade some of the provinces around Galilee, and news was coming in of the destruction. And as the people sat in the southern province of Judah, right down there in the south, you can imagine them watching the news at 10 or whatever it happened to be. It must have been a terrifying experience. Over the course of their lives, they've really witnessed the doctrinal and moral collapse of God's people. And it's not just the kind of sentimental nostalgia that you sometimes hear. They've seen the leaders of God's people becoming increasingly secular and godless down in Judah. They've watched as group after group of God's people have abandoned God. They've gasped in horror as the values and standards that once epitomized Judah and Israel began to collapse and disintegrate. And now, in the 8th century BC, Judah begins to feel the chill wind of God's judgment. Just look at two verses in chapter 8 across the page that show us what is really going on. There in chapter 8, verse 17. Do you see the Lord is hiding his face from the house of Jacob? 8:22 puts it even more strongly. Then they will look towards the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom. And they will be thrust into utter darkness. So do you see that as these Assyrian armies probe down into northern Israel, into the provinces of Zebulun and Naphtali and Galilee, well, it's more than just a military issue that is at stake here. This is God's land. These are God's historical people. And if you're one of the tiny band of faithful people left down there in the south, that handful of remnant believers, well, you're asking yourself this question, aren't you? Has God really given up on us? What of those great promises of salvation and of judgment and a blessing that he made to Abraham and to his descendants? And Isaiah 9, 1-7 is written to answer that question. First, a promise of a glorious future, verses 1-5. Secondly, a promise of an extraordinary child, verses 6-7. Verse 1. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who were in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and Naphtali. But in the future, he will honour Galilee of the Gentiles by way of the sea along the Jordan. Do you see? There will be a day in the future when the land that is now shamefully overrun with Assyrians is especially honoured by God. And verses 2-5 show us just what it is that God is going to do on that glorious day when he chooses to honour Galilee of the Gentiles. Verse 2. It will be a day of light and the lifting of God's anger. Verse 3. It will be a day of rejoicing and revival. Verses 4-5. It will be a day of rescue and rest. Now we'll come back to those in just a moment and tackle them one at a time. But before we do that, did you notice the tense of the verses as we went through reading 2-5 earlier? It's a past tense. Verse 2, they have seen. Verse 3, you have enlarged. Verse 4, you have shattered. Do you see? It's a promise. A promise for the future. But it's a promise made by God. And so God can talk about his future plans as if they're already certain and accomplished. Such is his power and authority that when he makes a manifesto, he can guarantee to keep it without fear of rebellion by maverick MPs. His promise is absolutely sure. So he makes his promise for the future in the past tense. Now let's have a look at the verses. It will be a day of light and the lifting of God's anger, verse 2. The people, walking in darkness, have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. When the God of life and light hides his face in anger, death and decay are the resulting hallmarks. That's always been the way. Remember back to Genesis 3 when Adam and Eve rebelled against God? The inevitable consequence of God's wrathful anger against them was their being cut off from the tree of life. And since that day, the dark shadow of death has hung over every generation, community, family, and reminds us relentlessly that we live in a world under the shadow of death as a result of our rebellion against the author of life. See what Isaiah says here? A day will come when the people living under the wrath of God will see a great light. And if you've ever been up at dawn, now's quite a good time of the year to try if you've never tried it before. About 7 o'clock is round about the kind of time the sun creeps up. If you've ever been up at that time, well, you'll know just what is going on. The picture's brilliant, isn't it? When the light dawns, well, the shadows are rolled back and the gloom and the darkness is dispelled. So this light, when this light dawns in verse 2, the darkness of God's judgment and wrath and death will be dispelled forever. The curse that has stood against God's creation and is now specifically directed at Judah down there in the south will be lifted when this light dawns. It will be a day of light and the lifting of God's wrath. But verse 3 tells us it will be a day of rejoicing and revival. Let's have a look at it. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as men rejoice when dividing the plunder. Now, do you see that word enlarged in verse 3? It is the same word that God uses when he makes his promises to Abraham way back in Genesis. There he promises to enlarge or multiply the family of Abraham when he blesses them. I will surely bless you. I'll make your descendants as numerous as the stars in the sky and the sand on the seashore. I will multiply your descendants, is what he says to Abraham. And again, you see, the point is obvious. God has not given up on his people, says Isaiah. He hasn't given up on this promise to Abraham. In the midst of all this gloom and depression, dismay and despair in Judah, God holds out again the promise to reverse the effects of the fall, to bless Abraham's descendants, to multiply the numbers, and to bring about a day of international rejoicing, when instead of nations gathering to bicker and haggle and dispute about climatic warning, they will gather to rejoice and praise God. And the reason is given for their praising is given in verses 4 and 5. The international rejoicing will become as a result of a great act of rescue followed by rest for God's people. Just have a look at the verses. For as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood, will be destined for burning, will be fuel for the fire. This international rejoicing, this vast world party, if you like, will come as a result of rescue and rest for God's people. And there will be rejoicing and rest because God will have accomplished a vast victory. And the point's made there in the ninth word of verse 4. You see it there? You have shattered the yoke that burdens them. See, it's a clear reference to the fact that it is God who is going to win the victory. And Isaiah underlines that point by mentioning two of the greatest rescues and victories won by God in his people's history. He rescued them from the yoke and burden of the Egyptians and from the yoke and burden of the Midianites. And in both occasions, God acted in the face of seemingly insurmountable odds to just wipe out his enemies and rescue his people. And then do you see verse 5? God will hold a vast bonfire, and on it will be heaped every imaginable item from the armory of God's enemies. Now, in Isaiah's days, God's enemies expressed the hostility to God in warfare. So the language is of technical equipment, so chieftain tanks and armor-like rifles of the equivalent of those days. All the items used against God and his people will be heaped up in a vast kind of junkyard and burned by God. In today's terminology, we would say the fuel for the fire would be every thought, every plan, every structure, every enemy of God. It'll be a day of total destruction of all God's enemies as they are shattered. But the emphasis is on the rest and rescue. This is a passage of hope. I suppose there are very few here this evening who can remember the end of any major military conflict fought by our nation. Pictures of, maybe one or two, pictures of London on VE Day in 1945 show just a tiny glimpse, don't they, of the national celebration and relief and rejoicing that comes when the enemy is conquered. Soldiers, sailors, airmen, mobbed, fated as they paraded through the streets of London. A day of immense national and international rejoicing. But this day will be so different. Unlike VE Day, there will be no casualties amongst God's people, no sad widows or wounded warriors. God's people will find that the victory has been won for them on their behalf by God. And unlike VE Day, which was just a brief respite in the world's wars, this will be an end to all hostility forever. When all the weapons of God's enemies are burned up in his vast, immense bonfire, well, there's going to be no enemy left. No more death. No more tears. No more hostility towards God and his people. No more sin. No more rebellion. Only international rejoicing for God's people. So now, do you see, as we've taken this sort of helter-skelter tour through the first five verses, that it is a promise of a glorious future day. It's a promise of heaven. And it's a promise that surely every single person here in this building must long for. Tomorrow morning, the children of the Chicken Shed Theatre Company release their single, I'm in Love with the World. It's pretty desperate, but it is billed as our only hope of rescue from a Teletubby Christmas. One of the lines of the song, which is really filled with sentimental nonsense, is this: I am in love with the world and its pain. Now, which of us can possibly say that we're in love with the world and its pain? I always want to ask you to stand up if you can say you're in love with the world and its pain. Show me one person who has experienced despair or disease or depression or family disputes or health disorders or death and who can honestly say, I'm in love with it. See, every one of us who's experienced those kind of things longs for a day when all the evidences of our dysfunctional relationship with God are dispelled forever. And Isaiah says, God has not given up on his promise to his people to bring such a world into being. For all the present day evidences of the broken relationship between God and his people down there in Judah, there is a day set when the pain of the world will end. And the handicapped kids of the Chicken Shed Theatre Company who trust God will walk free forever. And I want us to see now that the promise of verses 6 and 7 guarantee this future day. You see, you may be saying to me something like this: it's all very well for those primitive guys back there in 8th century BC Judah to hold on to some kind of utopian dream as they contemplate their impending destruction. But this is the late 20th century Western world. Isn't Isaiah just some kind of eternal optimist? A kind of Iron Age Richard Branson who just keeps on and on and on, repeating the ancient promises of God in the vain hope that one day, maybe, they might possibly be kept. See, he may put verses 1 to 5 in the past tense, but why should we believe him? Well, verses 6 to 7 provide the answer. God tells us that he will accomplish his promise of a glorious future through the birth and work of an extraordinary child. And this child will have an extraordinary birth. Look at verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. Now, that is a piece of poetry that basically says the same thing, but in two importantly different ways. This child is going to be born. That implies that it will have a natural, ordinary, human birth. So a child will be born. There's nothing extraordinary about that. It's quite a normal, everyday human event. You can, anytime you want, you can witness it. If you head off down to St. Thomas's maternity ward, you can see it. I recommend you don't bother except in cases of absolute extremis. But it is a perfectly normal thing. The second thing we're told about the child is extraordinary. Just have a look at verse 6 again. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. So this child will have a normal natural birth, and yet this child will be a gift. And that links us back to chapter 7 and verse 14, where God tells us, or Isaiah tells us, that the Lord himself will give a sign. The virgin will be with child and will give birth to a son, and you will call him Emmanuel, which means God with us. So do you see that this child that is to be born will be an extraordinary baby? And verse 7 underlines that. Just look at it. The increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time forward and forever. So he's going to be an eternal baby, living and reigning, not just for a week or a month or a few years or 75 years, but forever and ever. God is going to be born on earth as a relation to King David to rule forever. He will be fully human, born of a virgin, and yet divine, Emmanuel, God with us. And as if to confirm that we got it right in reading verse 6a like that, just have a look at the naming of the child, and we see that he has an extraordinary name. Now, naming a child is always difficult, nothing more so than in Hebrew culture, when the name you gave the child really carried significance. So as a parent, you would choose a name that you thought summed up all that the child was going to be. Like giving Sylvester Stallone the name Rocky and Rambo in his films. They tell us exactly what to expect. Rocky, the heavyweight boxer. Rambo, well, he's got to be a sort of SAS-style trooper. I mean, if they called him, I don't know, Fenella or something like that, it wouldn't have washed. So these names have enormous significance, especially so because they're given by God. Wonderful Counselor. Tells us that he is going to have supernatural wisdom and counsel. The word wonderful literally means miraculous or supernatural. So this child is going to have a wisdom and a counsel from God himself. He'll be all-knowing, all-wise. When this child is born, you would expect people from generation to generation to generation to marvel at his divine teaching and wisdom. And of course, this divine, supernatural wisdom will enable this child to rule in the kind of way that he will need to rule if he's going to bring about verses 1 to 5. Next, he will be called Mighty God. The word means literally God warrior. And the words are used just over the page in 10:21, chapter 10, verse 21, to speak of God himself. A remnant will return, a remnant of Jacob will return to the mighty God. So this child is going to be God himself, acting in divine mighty strength. No one will be able to stand up to him. But when this child is born, we'd expect him to have the ability of God himself to control his creation, to rule his enemies. We'd expect him to calm the storm, to heal the sick, to drive out the demon, to act like God's conquering warrior over God's enemies, and eventually to defeat death itself. So do you see the point? God is going to be born on earth. And again, we should expect him to have all the qualities that will enable him to shatter God's enemies and establish rest and freedom from death for God's people forever. And the next two names confirm that, don't they? The idea of the warrior God might fill you with fear, but Everlasting Father removes all terror because his rule will follow the pattern of God's perfect fatherhood. Awesome, yes, but the rule and discipline and care of a perfect father for his children. And Prince of Peace. Not peace on earth in this world now, but peace between men and women and God. The word translated peace is a word used to refer to all that flows out of right relationships between God and people. So now let's stop just for a brief moment and think about these names. I don't know if you've ever had to register the name of a new child. You go into the town hall, sit down, and some board official takes down the details. Father's name, mother's name, place of birth, date of birth, boy or girl, name. And if you're lucky, it's sort of, oh, how nice. But imagine for a moment registering the birth of this child. I was registering a baby just 10 days ago. I wish I'd tried it. I had a look through one of the books of names just recently, just to see if anybody's ever done it before. Look it up, if you like, under G. Gary, George, Geraldine, Gertrude, Gwyneth, Gwendolyn. As far as I can see, nobody has ever tried God. Imagine the gossip in the registry office. Do you know what they called him? An extraordinary birth. An extraordinary name. An extraordinary rule, verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. See what is going to happen to this extraordinary child? His rule will expand and extend over the whole of space, until eventually he rules over everything and everybody forever. There will be no maladministration, no corruption, no discontent, no exception. So what is the issue of this passage, written in something like 700 BC? What is the issue? The issue is this: has God given up on his people and his plans? Well, now, Isaiah's answer is a clear and resounding no. He has a glorious promise of a glorious future for the people of God. He will bring that future into being through the birth of an extraordinary child. So that the birth of that extraordinary child will act as a guarantee of the promise of the glorious future. You can see it there. For to us a child is born. How are we going to be sure this will happen? Well, for, because, to us a child is born. So the application of the passage to us should begin to be obvious. This child, when he's born, will obviously be unmistakable, won't he? His birth is highly likely to be a turning point in history. You'd expect news of the birth, wouldn't you, to travel out from the province of Galilee through the whole world like ripples on a pond. You'd expect news of the promise and the birth to reach even the barbarians in England, and then to be remembered and celebrated and looked back to from generation to generation to generation. And if there were a person in 1997 who were to hear of the birth of this child and to continue to live as if he doesn't exist, well, we'd have to say that that person, if they'd heard of the promise and then heard of the birth of the child, was making a profoundly foolish mistake. Because if this child were to be born, his birth would guarantee future glory for his people and future destruction for those who are not his people. Do you see that? God makes a promise in 700 BC, verses 1 to 5, of a glorious people and certain destruction, a glorious future for his people and certain destruction for his enemies. It will come about through a divine child being born on earth, living in Galilee, who will teach with divine wisdom such that his teaching is never forgotten, rule with divine power such that he can control his world, care for his people, and open the way to peace with God. Well, we might be forgiven for taking the promise with a pinch of salt if the second half of the promise had not been fulfilled. But if this child has been born, well, do you see that the fulfillment of the second half of the promise guarantees the certainty of the first? To go on living as if the child has not been born, well, would make all sort of life decision-making blunders pale into insignificance. Doing that would be to place oneself in the category of verses 4 and 5. I will be somebody who will be shattered. Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning and will be fuel for the fire. Now we're going to look at that next week as we look at Micah 1 to 5 and Christmas warning. But we mustn't go too far down that road, because this week is Christmas hope. And this message is written to God's people to tell us that God has not given up on his promises. And it may be that there are some people of God in 1997 here this evening who are rather like the faithful remnant in Judah in 700 BC. We ask ourselves, has God given up on us? What of his promises of a glorious future for his people? You know, we've seen the leaders of God's people become increasingly secular and godless. We've watched as the Christian church has, in the West, has gone into decline, and group after group of people appear to abandon God. We read the reports of 70 clergymen in the Church of England who no longer even believe in God. We gasp in horror at the values and standards of God's people, apparently going downhill and downhill and downhill. And each of us, every single one of us, faces the reality of living in God's world. The reality of sickness, depression, derision at the hands of God's enemy. And we long for God's long-promised future to be brought into being. Well, were this child not to have been born, we might wonder. But if this child has been born, then we can say with absolute confidence the fulfillment of the second half of the promise guarantees the certainty of the first half. And that means that as we celebrate the birth of this child, well, our thoughts will primarily be on the future. Because the fulfillment of the second half of the promise guarantees the future promised in the first half. And so the message that God's people preach as they remember the birth of this child will be essentially future-orientated. Not peace on earth now, not the end to global warming or economic inequality or political unrest now, not me and my personal fulfillment or even warm sentimental fuzzies now, but the absolute certain guarantee of the destruction of all God's enemies, of light and the lifting of God's wrath from his world forever, of rejoicing and revival, of rescue and rest in heaven forever. That should be the focus of our message this Christmas.